Many of us know how the story of Hanukkah goes. The Jewish people had finally returned to the temple after many years of occupation, humiliation, and near despair. They were celebrating, purifying, remembering, and reclaiming, for the Assyrian army had been defeated, and they were free. During the time of hiding in caves and fending off arrest, they had missed their great festival of Sukkot, which must be celebrated in the temple. And so now that they had returned, they began that ritual of the harvest a little late. They began it as their covenant with God required. As they began, however, they realized that the Assyrians had destroyed all but one night's worth of oil for the lamp, and they needed 8 days' worth. Anything less would not signify a true rededication or commitment to begin again as a religious community and as a people. After all they had been through, it mattered that they do it right and completely. Now, often when I've heard this story after this initial setup, it turns immediately to what the rabbis later call the miracle. The miracle being that rather than one day, as they had expected, the menorah stayed lit for the full 8 days. But for today's telling, for today, I want to point to something else. Something that happened before that more famous miracle. I want to look to the choice that was made. The choice that they made to light that first candle, even though it didn't have enough oil. And I want to affirm that choice in and of itself as also a miracle. In lighting the candle, the Jews held together an important paradox, a paradox that all of us are called to hold as Unitarian Universalists, as people of spiritual maturity, that is the paradox, on the one hand, of accepting the reality of the oil as it was, not enough, disappointing, a symbol of all that had been taken from them. And yet on the other, in their choice to light it anyway, they also held the expectation that something more was possible. Something beyond their current sight or understanding, a greater hope for the world as it was meant to be. As the story has come to us, it is important that the Jewish people did not hold just one awareness or the other of that moment. It was both, a total letting go of expectations, acceptance of life as it was, and also an expectation of life in its most possible sense. Long before I knew what the past few weeks would hold, I knew I would be preaching on expectations today. It is the theme for the month of December and a fitting one for the holiday season. Most of us expect a little, or maybe a lot, of things to be true or to happen this time of year. Many of us expect this season to be especially fun or joyful, or maybe we expect the opposite. Many expect the spirit of the holidays to somehow take over their usual lives, for this time to feel special or different. Some of us even imagine if, even for a moment, the world will become itself an ideal. Conflicts, both national and familial, will be resolved. Peace and kindness and love will rule. In the most day-to-day sense, we often expect that somehow we'll be able to do 4 times as much as usual, but with much less stress or irritation. We expect our children, grandchildren, friends, spouses to look just like they do on Facebook or in the holiday card. So calm and cheery all the time, especially since we'll be spending so much time with them. And we definitely expect not to get sick or lose our job, for the car to break down, or for any of that regular life stuff to interfere with this special time. I started to think about this month's theme over the summer when I first heard the podcast from NPR called Invisibilia. It's about the impact of invisible things. One of their episodes is about expectations and how other people's expectations are acting on us all the time. It tells the story of a man named Daniel who became blind as a toddler and whose mother never expected him to live any differently than a sighted person. And as a result, Daniel never expected his life to be limited in any meaningful way by his blindness. From an early age, Daniel developed a version of echolocation. So he learned to click in order to locate himself in space. And then this adaptation, in turn, has freed him to live his life with confidence and without restrictions, just as his mother had expected. Daniel's actually known, if you look up the podcast, it's called How to Become Batman. But he's known especially because he's able to ride a bike, which he literally has no eyes. So if you can imagine, and he started riding his bike when he was about, when kids ride bikes, 5, 6, somewhere in there. So if you know a 6-year-old boy at all, then you probably know they don't go slow on their bikes. And so in the podcast, it talks about this. He did this thing like called dive bombs, where he would start at the top of a hill on his bike and ride down. And so they have this, he describes how it was like. He said he had a few incidents with the teeth along the way, but but mostly he was fine. Daniel's story is offered in contrast to one of his friends, Adam, who's also blind. Unlike Daniel, Adam had been given assistance to get around his whole life. He went to a school for the blind. And the people around Adam expected Adam to need help and to be limited by his blindness. And the more people that offered him assistance, the more then Adam came to expect it. And then the more his capacity aligned with all those expectations. Now, despite what you might be thinking, this story is not an anomaly, and it is not without research to back it up its findings. As research psychologist Melanie Panola reports, if you want to change your experience, change your expectations. What you think will happen may even affect you physically. For example, in one study, golfers were told they had a lucky ball. They made more putts than they did when they had an ordinary ball. Similarly, a teacher's expectations have been shown to raise or lower a student's IQ score. Not just like any old test, but their IQ score. The expectations of a military trainer can raise or lower the running speed of a recruit. And parental expectations can significantly impact the behavior of a child. This is like the placebo effect, but played out in the social and cultural sphere. We don't totally understand why it works, but we have sufficient evidence now to say that it does. Of course, there are limitations to the impact of expectations. And those limitations are what often lead us to what I think of as the more traditional spiritual wisdom about expectations. That is, that they are a setup for disappointment and suffering, and so are to be avoided. As the Buddha has said, serenity comes when you trade expectations for acceptance. In her great work, When Things Fall Apart, Buddhist nun Pema Chodron describes this fundamental truth as a matter of staying in the present, of letting go of either worrying about the past or the future, and instead receiving this moment just as it is. As she says, the spirit of true awakening is about letting go of everything. My professor used to say that the Buddhist way of thinking about ultimate truth is like an onion. That is, you peel away all the layers of truth to get to ultimacy, and in the center, there's nothing. The idea is because everything is interdependent, so there's too many moving parts that are interacting and impacting and changing each other all the time to say that there is ever any independent thing, which means that the reality of everything is nothing. This paradoxical concept is what leads to the spiritual wisdom of letting go of expectations. Everything is impermanent all the time. And instead, our job is to accept life as it is right now and making room then for all that we do not and cannot know. For ultimately, there is nothing there. Expecting nothing frees us then to the present moment, allows us to experience the here and now as what Chodron calls the perfect teacher, even when, and especially when, this present moment is not something that we would have happily anticipated. She says, the most precious opportunity presents itself when we come to the place where we think we can't handle whatever is happening. Most of us, however, do not take these situations as teachings. We automatically hate them and we run from them. We guard off our heart, become defensive, closed in one way or another, either angry, despairing, avoidant, addicted, or apathetic. The spiritual task, however, invites the opposite, not close off, but rather to stay awake to the pain, to let it in, and to make more rather than to resist connections in the midst of this awareness. To find gratitude and joy, even when, most especially when, things fall apart. And it is in this awareness and acceptance that allows us to hold life as it is, unpredictable, impermanent, and yet still wondrous, profoundly beautiful, and filled with love. I ran into Rabbi Shoshana from Congregation Har Shalom by chance at a coffee shop on Thursday, both of us hurried and rushing. When she saw me, she didn't even say hello. She just said, "We aren't doing enough." And I said, "I know." I said I'd call her to talk about Hanukkah to prepare for this Sunday. She said, "No, let's sit down. Let's study together." She was to teach on Friday night, so she needed the conversation too. So on Friday afternoon, all afternoon, we read and reread the rabbinic texts, the historic accounts, the commentaries, and the kids' versions of Hanukkah. A friend of hers even stopped by to offer insight. And along the way, threaded throughout, we lamented San Bernardino, Colorado Springs, and the 353 other such mass shootings that have happened in this country in this calendar year. And the year isn't over yet. "We need a peace march," she said. "Can we sing?" I asked. "It's not enough," we both said. Perhaps you know the story of Hanukkah, the parts about the lamp, is not historical. The historical account is one of a relatively extremist sect of Judaism called the Maccabees taking to violent protest to overthrow an emperor whose nickname was Madman. Not everyone resisted, however, it turns out. Some of the Jews instead assimilated, and they found ways to simply go along. The miracle in the historical account was about a small community of people who refused to go along and refused to accept the world as it was, and then succeeded in their refusal. The lamp story, on the other hand, was added later and emphasized as the ritual for the holy days of Hanukkah by the rabbis because they felt the critical moral lesson from this period should not be about violent uprising. They felt that it should instead be about God's intervention, the importance of faith, and a reclaiming of Jewish values and practices. As Rabbi Arthur Weskow observes, the Maccabean historical tradition affirms human courage and doggedness, the human ability to make history and bend and change, the need to organize, to act, to fight, to build might and use power. And on the other hand, the rabbinic tradition of Hanukkah celebrated not might and not power, but a kind of inwardness and contemplation that was contradictory to insurgent politics. Waska wonders, is there a way for those of us celebrating Hanukkah today to hold both of these perspectives, the rabbi and the Maccabee, the deep awareness and contemplation of what is, and the call for change, to reconcile these supposed opposites as instead two parts of a greater truth? Many of my friends and colleagues are getting into their pulpits this morning to express outrage, which I think is valid, and one true way to respond to the world as it is. However, I am not sure, as one of you wrote in a comment on my blog this week, that the world needs more outrage. Instead, we might consider what witness of hope and life we might offer in the midst of this ever-present pain, and how we might, in following Pema Chodron's wisdom, remain awake to this suffering, present to the fear and the chaos, not close ourselves off in any way, whether through outrage or denial or resignation, by calling names or assigning blame, but rather to take in the world as it is, this moment just as it is, and to expect nothing else. And then, in this full acceptance, to bear witness to the resilience of love, joy, kindness, compassion, laughter and silliness, and to hold space for all that we do not yet know. And, on the other hand, our faith compels us to tend to the story of hope, the story, as Victoria Safford puts it, of those who lived their lives and gave their lives for love, for a difficult and truly patriotic ideal of liberty and justice for all. Our Unitarian Universalist faith asks us to orient our lives according to that hopeful story and to live out of the possibility and expectation that we are meant for something more. Something more possible, more hopeful and good, to affirm there is more love somewhere, more compassion, more peace, still and always possible. And as the studies show, it is by expecting such a world that such a world becomes more likely. Which means our faith asks us to expect that we can change. That we can expect a world that places a greater value on human life in all of its complexity and imperfection than we do on access to weapons designed specifically to end those same lives quickly and efficiently. For too long and for too often, we have been the assimilated Jews denying the war that is already broken out in our country, failing to join the resistance. For too long, we have failed to kindle the flame that is ours because we couldn't imagine it would be enough, that we or our efforts would be enough to do what needs to be done. But we cannot turn away any longer. We need to light our small flame wherever it may be and see what new thing emerges. Refuse to get too caught up in our expectations of efficacy. As Vaclav Havel says, hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. In terms of policies, I don't know. I'm not a policymaker. I'm a clergy person. But like many of you, I've read 1,000 articles in the past few weeks, and most of them indicate that even a few small changes could reduce the likelihood of gun violence, mass and otherwise. So let's at least advocate that we can have the conversation, that we can do the studies, that we won't be so stuck in a fundamentalism that says unrestricted access to all weaponry is our only option, that we throw up our hands and say, this is the best we can do. I don't know what will be enough. It may not be. But we have to begin. This holding of paradox, of both expecting nothing and yet everything, of being fully present to life as it is and yet making space for something more. This is a life practice. It's a life orientation, an orientation that allows us to remain open and awake to life as it actually is, without giving in to despair. It's helpful for this moment, but it's also necessary for all the ways that life is both heart-wrenching and still possible, painful and yet still sweet and silly and filled with so much good. As we move through this holiday season and throughout our walk together, may we keep waking up, keep making space for all that is yet meant to be. Let us be the makers of miracles, refusing to believe that this beauty we have within and among us is not yet enough to change the world. It could be. Let's see.